You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1994 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Ian Finley on the subject, Put on Beautiful Garments, O Jerusalem.
Talking about Herod's death 4 years before the birth of Christ. This is kind of puzzling to particularly young children when you try to explain that Christ's birth is usually considered to be 4 B.C., not zero. And yet, you know, we're in the year 1994, which is supposedly from the very birth date of Christ. But the reason the historians feel that Christ was born around 4 B.C. was that Christ was within the reign of the hated Herod. And he it was who summoned the wise men of the East to inquire to find the child that I may come and worship him also. And the wise men, of course, warned by God, did not report back. And then we find that Herod died around the latter part of the year 4 B.C. So if that's true, if Christ was born 4 years before the recorded date, that means that the year 1996 looms large with prophetic students who feel that God has a 7,000-year plan. And the sixth day will all be over in 1996, and the millennium would begin in 1997, if we can put that forth as a suggestion only. Just a quick comment by Teddy Kollek. The reason I quote him is, as I mentioned, he's the best-known mayor in the world, or was. And in speaking about Jesus in his book, he's very respectful, but he's non-committal about Jesus. And of course, very wisely so, inasmuch as billions of tourist dollars have flowed into Jerusalem in the last 40 years. And here's what he says. Jesus of Nazareth wandered the country giving ethical values of Old Testament Hebrew prophets. He used simple language, the parables of telling directness. He had charismatic power and magnetic leadership. His exhortations on brotherhood, kindness, charity, and equity of rich and poor before God were profound. The authorities hated him as a dangerous rebel. And Teddy, of course, misses the point. As we all know, how's that for focus? Well, I can't get the whole thing and settle for the middle. Oh. Terrific. So, we're all familiar with these words, but for the tape I'll say them. And the word, and the angel said unto her, Fear not, Mary, for thou hast found favor with God. And behold, thou shalt conceive in thy womb and bring forth a son and shall call his name Jesus. He shall be great and shall be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. And then, of course, the punchline that Teddy would not understand or appreciate even if he read it. And he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. Moving on, when the time was come, Jesus, we find in Luke 9, set his face to go to Jerusalem. Knowing that if he forsook Galilee at this time and headed to Jerusalem at Passover, he was at high risk. But Jesus headed south through Samaria and Jericho on his ascent to Jerusalem, going through Bethany and Bethpage, crossing the shoulder of the Mount of Olives. You can just see the Mount of Olives. He would be coming up from through Samaria, up through Jericho, and ascending to Jerusalem and across the shoulder of the Mount of Olives through Bethany and Bethpage. In Mark 14 and at verse 17, I'd like you to turn there if you will. Incidentally, from here to the end of the school week, I spent yesterday afternoon cutting a tremendous amount of material out of my notes. We just aren't going to cover it. So I've culled it down to what I consider to be the very important parts that I want you to get. To compensate, as we mentioned, Brother Ted has arranged that we will get photocopies of those dates and the events that happened on each of those dates. We'll photocopy those at least. In Mark 14, verse 17, we read, and in the evening he cometh with the 12. And after sending the disciples in advance, we find that Jesus crosses the Kidron. They're over here. Tradition says the site of the Last Supper was here, and that he dispatched the disciples, and then he went across in verse 26. And when they had sung an hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. So he would... I'm sorry, first of all, when he came this way, he crossed the Kidron, right? Then the Last Supper, and after they had sung a hymn, he went out and they crossed the Kidron. He crossed the Kidron again in verse 26. And in verse 53, and they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests and elders and the scribes. This is the final crossing of our Master when he was taken away, probably through this area here, to his trial and death. And that was the final crossing of our Master of the Kidron. And I'm emphasizing this for a purpose that I'll approach later in the week. Jesus was taken from Gethsemane. And incidentally, that Gethsemane means get Shemanim, an oil press, something that I think you were referring to. It's interesting in passing that he ended up, of course, at Golgotha, which many people feel now is in this area here that I showed you the picture of, just outside Damascus Gate. And if you can see the terrain here, here's Mount Moriah stretching up through here. And in Sultan Suleiman Street, which I showed you from the slides, here's the Rockefeller Museum. This has been carved through the northern part of Mount Moriah. So, if Christ was indeed crucified there, we read that in... 1 Samuel 17, we won't look this up, and 2 Samuel 5, David took Goliath's head, and he brought it to Jerusalem, and it has been speculated that he brought it to Mount Moriah. And if indeed he did, this constitutes Mount Moriah, and wouldn't it be remarkable if it was the same spot where Goliath's head was on the sword, where our Master was crucified. And of course, there's all sorts of parallels that we can draw there. And a brother this week mentioned to me that there is some dispute as to whether Abraham offered Isaac at this precise spot here. And wouldn't that be interesting that that sacrifice took place there as well? So these are all interesting speculations. Okay. Where are we now? AD 66, the 70, excuse me. Okay, we're coming to the period of the Great Revolt. After Agrippa died in 44 AD, his son, King Agrippa II, did not actually rule Judea, but had some authority in the northern provinces. In Jerusalem, he was given the right to supervise the temple. But the real power was the Roman procurator. And as we know, one followed another with increasing harshness on the Jewish population. Amongst the Jews of Jerusalem, the official leaders were mostly the Sadducees, but the actual leaders that they followed in their day-to-day lives and their spiritual guides were the Pharisees. And they were divided roughly into two groups. There was the moderates, or we would say doves today, who favored pacifism. In other words, we're under the Roman yoke for God's purpose, so therefore let's get along as best we can. And then there were the activists. And of the activists, there were two groups. There were the hawks, who favored resistance and non-submission to the Roman power, and the zealots, or eagles, as they were referred to, who called for actual armed resistance to the Roman yoke. So in AD 66, this war of the Jews against the Romans began, and it lasted 5 years, ending with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. There's actually been coins struck for each year. In AD 66, which was year one, a coin was struck, and it says for the first year of the revolution. And year two, the holy shekel of Jerusalem was the second year of the revolt. And for year three, which would be AD 68, three of those coins were recently found at Masada. So this is all corroborated historically. And year four and year five, AD 70, they have found the odd coin. It's a very, very rare and very valuable coin. In AD 68, Vespasian set out to restore the Roman rule, and he fought his way through the land to Jerusalem. At the time, Rome was rocked by political upheaval, so Vespasian decided to wait things out to see if he was going to be without a job or if he might become the emperor. Well, as it turned out, in AD 69, Vespasian did become the emperor, and he went to Rome and sent back out to Palestine his son Titus. And he was made commander of the armies in Judea and put in charge of the attack on Jerusalem. And Jerusalem's inhabitants had been given a breather, you might say. Let's look at that. It's interesting in the sense of the Mount Olivet prophecy. In Luke chapter 21, the Roman hordes are about to decimate Jerusalem, and they have the people holed up in the area under siege. And verse 20 of Luke 21, we read, "Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which were written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." So, it is speculated that those of wise heart and God-fearing sees this hiatus, this pause in the proceedings to get out. But most others, history records, squandered this hiatus on bitter and inner family quarrels and conflict described in Ezekiel's early chapters. So in AD 70, in the spring, Titus with four legions began the battle. And it's interesting that Colic and Perlman in their book give great attention to the small and minor victories that the Jews had against the Romans, which is understandable. But the end was inevitable. And Titus decided to, maybe I could show it by this. Titus decided to weaken them with starvation. So a ring of siege was created. So no supplies could reach the people. And this is what they call a circumvallation. And to this day, I know for a fact near the Khan nightclub down in this area here, there's still evidence of the Roman encirclement. And the way they went about this, the walls of Jerusalem were roughly like so. This is on the inside of the city. So the Romans built a large, what would you call these things? Structures. Sort of like we would call a, the tower. Terrific. Yeah. And down below, these men would have, these here fellows would have crowbars, and these fellows would have battering rams. So they're weakening it, below and above. But anyway, they finally breached the wall, and on the ninth day of Ab, that famous ninth day, the very month and day on which 650 Jewish years earlier, the Babylonians, in 587 B.C., had sacked the first temple on this site, the forces of Titus broke into the inner temple and set the sanctuary ablaze. Thousands of civilians, including women and children, were butchered as the Roman legionnaires ran throughout the streets. And as we saw in the slide, or at least I alluded to it, they have since found a burnt house with occupants to corroborate this very happening. And they carried off many to use as slaves, and some were thrown to wild beasts at the games in Caesarea. And here we see in the famous arch at Rome a depiction of this victory of Titus over the Jews at Jerusalem and the seven-branched menorah borne on the victorious shoulders, I suppose, of the Roman conquerors. And the dispersal took place at that time, which is shown on this chart of the 70 AD. And in the cross-hatching, you can see the areas of Jewish dispersal and settlement after the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70 AD. So down both legs of the Roman Empire, you can see how the Jews were scattered, as it was forecast by the prophets of old, even up in the pockets here. Now we realize that prior to this, in the Assyrian conquest, there was a great migration of Jews down this way. That's not shown on here. This was the dispersal of 70 AD. Now, in 132 to 135, you've probably all heard of Bar Kokhba. And this is when he came on the scene. So despite the fact that the Romans had taken over Palestine, Jewish life did not cease. It returned slowly to some form of normalcy. And the Roman governor ruling from Caesarea gave little thought to Jerusalem. Caesarea was their focal point. The temple was gone. There was no worship allowed. So religious life of the Jews centered around Yavne. And that's a town on the Mediterranean coast, just north of Ashkelon, and to this day it is a center of Talmudic studies dating back to this period. And the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Jewish Council, now drawn from the leading Jewish scholars. It was in this period that Jewish educational patterns were fashioned, which were to guide them forever to prize scholarship and learning above all things. And we all have Jewish friends and acquaintances, and we know to this day that they treasure scholarship and learning, and they're extremely good at it. Also then, the rabbis laid the foundation for the rigid observance of the Jewish law, which had such a unifying influence on scattered Jewish communities resisting absorption into Roman and many others' culture. So you can see the hand of God at work even in this terrible time for the Jews. The seeds were sown for the culture and thirst for learning and the synagogue observance and emphasis on the Torah, which kept them together as a people. Now in 132, let's put our main events up again. All right, 132, Bar Kokhba's War of Freedom. Bar Kokhba and his guerrillas struck. The Jewish War of Freedom was on. And I don't think Christadelphians give enough attention to this period because we tend to date the dispersal of the Jews from AD 70, which is true about Jerusalem, but it's not true of Palestine as a whole. This is more to the era of Bar Kokhba. So the main aim was to free Jerusalem from the Romans. So pretty soon, all Judea was ablaze. And here we have one of Martin Gilbert's charts on the various wars of successful battles against the Romans. And you can see that they were quite successful. Where's it oriented here? This would be, I guess, Jerusalem, now called Herodium. And they drove the, well, here's Jerusalem, sorry. They drove the Romans out of these areas. But the end came at Bethur, a few miles southwest of Jerusalem on the 9th of Ab, again, the date on which the first and the second temples were destroyed. And at that point, it was to take the Jews another 1,813 years to regain independence. I'd like to read to you from a report by Megan Broshy, who is the curator of the Shrine of the Book in Jerusalem, about this era. And interestingly, for prophecy buffs, this was a 3.5-year period that the Bar Kokhba revolts took place. He says, the events of this period are poorly documented, but this is one of the most decisive chapters in the history of the country and of the Jewish people, and had far-reaching consequences. The revolt lasted 3.5 years. During this period, the Jews retook Jerusalem. They may even have attempted to rebuild the temple, but they were unable to hold the city for more than 2 years. After 3 years, the rebellion against Rome collapsed. Hundreds of thousands of Jews had been slain, and hundreds of thousands more were taken captive. The Jewish population of the southern part of what the Romans were to call Palestine were uprooted. From 135, when Hadrian carried out his original intention of building a Roman city on the site of Jerusalem, which he called Aelia Capitolina, after his own name, Aelius, and Capitolina, Jupiter, the circumcised were prohibited from approaching the city, not only Jews, but also Jewish Christians, under penalty of death. The circumcised were banned from living in Jerusalem and its vicinity, and even from visiting. But for the next 5 centuries, it was illegal for the Jews to live in or visit Jerusalem. But as we can see, in 135, that was the final dispersion, you might say, of the Jewish people from their land. So at this point, AD 35, it is said by historians, before this, the Jews were a nation. After it, they were a people. To the Jews, however, and I'm quoting from Norman Kotger in his book, The Earthly Jerusalem, to the Jews, however, this catastrophe was just one more painful reversal in a history of many reversals and part of a mysterious process that would lead someday to the coming of Messiah. And now we enter the Byzantine period, which we see here, 324 to 638. Constantine became emperor with direct rule over Jerusalem, and a gale of change, we are told, swept Jerusalem. Henceforth, it became for Christians what it had been for Jews for 13 centuries, their holy city. Constantine became passionately involved with Christianity / paganism. In 325 AD, he called the Council of Nicaea, and his mother Helena was there also. Helena resolved, when the council was over, to visit Jerusalem. She and Marcus, a bishop of Aelia Capitolina, which was the new title for Jerusalem, identified the site of the crucifixion, I put identified in quote marks, the site of the crucifixion and the burial relics of Jesus. These discoveries started the tradition of the main Christian sites followed to this day, such as, say, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. For a time, Jerusalem became exclusively a Christian city with two or three centuries of churches and monasteries and shrines, etc. In fact, the city became cluttered with these things, which, of course, it is to this day, which has some future implications, which we hope to touch on. So, the Byzantium reign was for the 5th and 6th centuries. Byzantium later became Constantinople, and now, of course, it's Istanbul. In 614, Emperor Heraclius ordered the Jews of the empire to accept baptism. And then the rest of these we can have photocopied and provide you with. But Dome of the Rock, or Mosque of Omar, that we've talked about many times this week, was not, in fact, built by Caliph Omar, even though it's often attributed to him. And that is the place where the legend occurred, where Muhammad left this earth on his winged steed to go to heaven. It's also the place, as we mentioned, where many feel that Abraham offered Isaac, and it is the site of the Holy of Holies. But in 685 to 705, the Dome of the Rock was built by a caliph named Abd el-Malik. And it was Byzantine architects and local craftsmen who, it is said, originally used pure gold for the dome. But it's interesting that through the years, this dome on this famous structure has been constructed of hair and wool and leather. And at this point in time, as of this moment, it is, of course, now gold-plated aluminum, and the job has just been finished. Now, the Arabs renamed this area, this whole plateau that was built up by Herod, Haram Esh Sharif, which means noble sanctuary. And the reason they built this place, this structure, and it's important for us to realize this too, it was a political reason, first of all, to offset the powerful rival for tourist attraction in Mecca. It was built for economic reasons to bring revenues from the pilgrims all over Europe that would come to the Middle East and from the Mediterranean areas as well. It was built for religious reasons to outdo all these other structures that are dotted around Jerusalem that were built by the Christians and so on. In 1067, an earthquake struck Jerusalem and the rock was actually split. And the dome, however, escaped damage. Now, in 1099, the Crusaders occupy Jerusalem. And this precipitated, among many things, by the destruction of their Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is shown, well, I haven't got this thing on the screen, but that's the alleged holiest shrine of Christendom, the Holy Sepulchre. So at one point in time, it was destroyed. So the Crusaders took over the dome, and they referred to it as Templum Domini, the dominant temple. And eventually, a Crusader was offered the throne. That was King Baldwin I. His title was King Baldwin I, the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem again became a capital. I won't take the time for this one, but land was allocated to the church under control of the Latin Patriarch, and there was a feverish drive to erect churches, hospices, convents, monasteries, homes for clergy, etc. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built over the ruins of Hadrian's Temple of Venus. And it's an interesting comment here in Bezak's Guide for Tourists. It says, Helena was the world's first and most successful archaeologist. Wherever she dug, she found exactly what she was determined to find. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is divided up even to this day between the Greek Orthodox, the Franciscan Order, the Armenian Church, the Coptics, and the Roman Catholics. It depends on what time of day you go in there as to who's going to hit you up for coins. The Golden Gate, and we've talked about a number of times. This is on the east wall, and directly the other side of this tower is the temple site. Originally thought to be the Gate Beautiful of Herod's time, and it's interesting. Why don't we just look this up in Ezekiel? This is where the interesting legend or tradition comes from. In Ezekiel 44, verses 1, 2, and 3. Then he brought me back by the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary, which looketh toward the east, and it was shut. Then said the Lord unto me, This gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter in by it. Because the Lord, the God of Israel, hath entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. It is for the prince, he shall sit in it to eat bread before the Lord. Now don't go away saying that Brother Finley is suggesting that this is a sign of the future, that this gate is going to be opened by our Lord and King. And this is a tradition that that the early Jews held, that it was through this gate where their Messiah would come up the Kidron Valley and go through this gate, which would open of its own accord, and he would come to his temple. And as we mentioned, there's grave sites around here where people wanted to participate in the resurrection and judgment and go in with the Messiah. The Muslims have built grave sites to block any Jews from doing that. And we think we've got troubles. In Crusader times, this gate was opened two times a year, Palm Sunday and the finding of the cross. But, of course, it's since been bricked up, and it's impossible to open. All right, we come to the Mamluk period, 1250 to 1517. Just have a quick comment on this. A line of sultans ruled for the next 267 years. Mamluks are, the word means slaves. It's Arabic for owned. They were mostly Turks and Circassians from Russia, which would include Kurds and Mongols, etc. And they greatly adorned Haramesh Sharif, the Temple Mount area, with fountains and arcades and minarets. And many of the things you see there on a visit are the result of their structures. The beginning of the Mamluk rule, the Jerusalem population was 40,000 Jews. By the end, there were only 10,000. Due to poor administration, indifference, poverty, earthquakes, famines, etc. In the very last days of this period around 1516, the Ottoman, which is a corruption of the word Osmanali, the Ottoman Turkish dynasty founded by the Sultan Osman I at the end of the 3rd century swept them away. And then we come into the interesting era of where the Ottomans expanded their great empire for the next 400 years. And it's interesting that they went into Egypt and Syria and just the borders of other countries, which I will show you by maps a little later on, God willing. 1538 to 40, Suleiman the First, the Magnificent. Suleiman the Magnificent, you hear his name mentioned often in the streets of Jerusalem. They still think very highly of this man. He left an impressive mark on Jerusalem. And I won't go into all the details, but he divided it up into vilayets or provinces and had a pretty tight administration, and they did a lot of building and whatever. The walls of old Jerusalem to this day are his work. And they are, of course, quite spectacular. But all this particular structure is his. Bearing in mind that many sections were in place from previous walls, and he would just improve on them. But generally speaking, they used the natural flow of the land. For example, at Damascus Gate, there's the natural ridge, so they used it. There's Sultan Suleiman Street, is there to this day. It runs from Damascus Gate, past Herod's Gate, to the Stork Tower at the corner, right there. The finest example of his architecture is the Damascus Gate itself. However, Jerusalem meant very little to the Turks. And that's important for us to remember as well. Bribing was the order of the day, and taxation was left to individual rulers, or pashas as they were referred to. And as long as he maintained a set flow to Constantinople, he could squeeze the populace for as much as he could get. If a farmer was unable to pay his taxes, his trees were cut down. And so I finally got the right answer as to why the area was denuded. I had heard different things. I'd heard that the Turks in the First World War had trains and they couldn't get coal for their engines, so they cut the trees down to use for fuel and all these different things. But apparently this was the reason, that they chopped the trees of Israel down for to pay their taxes. And as a result, it turned it into a wasteland. I think it was Mark Twain who went there and said, you know, it was a God-forsaken desert, barren wasteland. It wasn't the lush thing that you see today by any means. But these cruel methods of taxation applied mainly to the Jews of Jerusalem. The Roman Catholics had a feared connection to France that the Ottoman wouldn't disturb too much. The Greek Orthodox had the Russian Tsars standing in protection of them. But the Jews, as usual, had no one to stand up for them. So as a result, the Ottoman Turk did lean on the Jews. In 1799, Napoleon tried to wrest Palestine from the Turks. And the British Navy came to the rescue. And Napoleon withdrew. And just recently, in 1991... there were some coins found by some scuba divers off Acre, commemorating this precise event. A British and French rivalry along the coasts of the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea was to have a profound effect on Jerusalem, for it unleashed a nationalism of Arab versus Jew. Whereas before, they could get along sort of as the half-brothers that they are, or cousins at the worst. But this aroused the concerns of nationalism. Interesting to note that up to 1860, Almost no one lived outside of these walls. They all lived within the city. It was too dangerous to live outside. At night, the robbers and marauders reigned supreme. 1836, Sir Moses Montefiore received from the Sultan of Constantinople the rights to acquire land outside Jerusalem's walls. And a windmill still stands in a park just outside of the King David Hotel, or just beside the King David Hotel, marking that era of 1836 when they started to build and expand outside of the old walls of Jerusalem. 1860 was a period of the spiritual resurgence of the Return to Zion movement in Central and Eastern Europe. For most others around the world, it was the cry or the lament next year in Jerusalem. And although Europe was being swept with the liberty, equality, fraternity thing, Jews were being ghettoized and persecuted all through Europe. And most at that time went to Jerusalem, although some went to clear the swamps and revive the deserts, etc. In 1897, I don't know if it's on here or not, the date that's very memorable to Christadelphians, the World Zionist Movement was crafted, and Theodor Herzl was the prime mover. And Theodor Herzl said that within 50 years there would be a state. And he didn't know how prophetic he was, writing that in 1897. So, the next portion I have deserves some more attention, so I'll leave that for tomorrow. And, to me it is quite fascinating, what we're going to see as the Ottoman Empire begins to break up. And I want to share it with you. And I want to ask for your feedback from those of you who are concerned about these matters as well. Thank you.